From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Dr. Matt McCarthy has seen many patients die, patients who a generation ago or maybe even a decade ago might have survived, but now they're succumbing to superbugs, multiple drug-resistant pathogens that are mutating, spreading, and threatening the lives of ever more people around the world. We are at the end of a remarkable century of medicine, one that began with the almost miraculous breakthrough that came with the introduction of penicillin. But we need new antibiotics now, and there is exciting new science that could usher them in. But bureaucracy, broken economic models, and the speed of the pathogen's own evolution may stand in the way. McCarthy, though, has hope in his own story of trying to develop a breakthrough antibiotic. So this hour on Point, superbugs. And you can join us if you or someone you know been infected with a drug-resistant microbe. What happened? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And later this hour, we will talk about the growing Ebola crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo. But first, joining us from New York is Matt McCarthy. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the Weill Cornell and is a staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital and author of the new book, Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. Dr. Matt McCarthy, welcome to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, I mean, give us your sense or your thought about how large a problem these drug-resistant microbes are around the world. Are we right to be concerned?
We are right to be concerned. You know, this is one of the most important issues facing medicine. And we've seen a number of doomsday scenarios that have been projected. And people throw around numbers like 10 million deaths a year worldwide by 2050. I don't know if it's going to be that bad, but we are facing a breaking point. And the reason for that is that the bacteria and the fungi and the parasites in our environment are mutating so rapidly that they are figuring out ways to destroy even the best new antibiotics that we throw at them. And the reason this is a challenge for us is that big pharma isn't particularly interested in making more antibiotics. Mm. Increasingly, they're saying it just isn't worth it.
Yeah. So that number of 10 million deaths annually around the world by 2050 is one that I threw around at the very top of the hour. But it comes from the World Health Organization. So even they are sounding the alarm if it might be sort of on one end of the curve here.
I have mixed emotions when I hear that number. I think part of me says I'm glad that people are paying attention, but I don't want people to be fearful. I want people to recognize what the issue is and what we can do about it.
But talk to me about what you've seen in your own practice of medicine, because you opened the book with a case that came into the emergency department of a person who had been shot but had a drug-resistant bacteria pathogen problem. Tell us that story.
Yeah, that's this fascinating shift that I've seen in my medical career. I enrolled at Harvard Medical School in 2003, and at that time, most of the infections that we were treating in the emergency room were treatable with an oral antibiotic. And then over the next few years, things started to change, and we started needing to use intravenous antibiotics. And now I see increasingly that these intravenous antibiotics are no longer working, and we're struggling to find new treatments. And what I wanted to do with this book was to bring people into the hospital, mm-hmm. into the rooms of patients, to see what is going on with people. These are lives hanging in the balance. And a lot of people have written about the various bureaucratic issues and the financial issues and the red tape, all of these things that seem sort of at 30,000 feet. And I wanted to bring people into the lives to see what's happening to people as these issues play out and policies get tossed around. You know, people are vulnerable and they're dying, and we need to do something about it.
So tell us the person you opened the book with, named Jackson, what you call him, Jackson. What happened to him?
That's right. So he came in with a drug-resistant pathogen. He had no idea what that meant or what that would mean for his family or for his leg. But the challenge and the reason I chose to start with him is that his bacterium was resistant to every antibiotic at our disposal except for one. And that one happened to be colistin. And for your listeners, that's an antibiotic that we used a generation ago, but it essentially fell out of favor because it was so outrageously toxic. It can chew up the kidney and other organs, and it's a really harsh drug to use. But we've come back to it. And one of the reasons is that we are faced with these bacteria that have mutated so that they can chew up whatever new antibiotics we're throwing at them. And one of the drugs of last resort is now becoming one that we have to reach to occasionally to save people. And I start with him because I wanted to show that these pathogens are everywhere. He was a mechanic in Queens, had no idea what happened to him. And ultimately, the way that he was cured was not with an antibiotic. It was with a surgeon. And what I wanted to write about in my book is that although there's a lot of focus on developing new antibiotics, we need to think more broadly about non-antibiotic options as well, whether those involve CRISPR, whether those involve coming up with these bacteriophages. There's all kinds of interesting non-antibiotic options we have to address this expanding threat of superbugs. And I will just make a note that I know some people recoil at that name. And the reason for that is that they feel like it can be almost fear-mongering to put the word super before bug. And I don't want people to be misled by that terminology. And I'll tell you, this morning I saw a patient who, by every definition, had a superbug. He had a urinary tract infection, and the bacterium was resistant to 9 different antibiotics. But it was exquisitely susceptible to a very well-tolerated antibiotic, and I easily treated him, and he was going to go home. And he poses no threat to his family or to the wider community. And it's not always an issue where a superbug is a death sentence by any measure. And using that terminology, I think, creates heightened awareness, which is a good thing. But I don't want people to be fearful of these things, because when I walk into the hospital every day, I'm confident that we're going to cure the patients who have these superbug infections.
Right. But Dr. McCarthy, if I may just go back to Jackson for a second here. I mean, he had come in because he was shot, right? But you were there because of this infection. So did he have the infection beforehand?
We don't usually find out where the infection came from.
I see.
It may have been that the compromise – by being shot, you compromise a very important protective barrier, which is your skin. And any of the bacteria that are living harmlessly on your skin can seep into the blood and can seep into your bones and your muscle, and they can wreak havoc. And I chose to write about in my book about people with these skin infections where a seemingly harmless pathogen can essentially go haywire. And it has to do sometimes with the host and the immune system of the patient, and sometimes it has to do with the particular pathogen. And how all of these things play out in the body is an exquisitely interesting story, and one that has fascinated me for years. And I was thrilled to get a chance to put down on paper what I had been seeing, and also to offer some hope that this is something where there are an incredible array of remarkable scientists who are spending their lives trying to come up with new treatments. But the next step is, how do you get those discoveries in laboratories to the patients who need them most?
Right. And so I want to talk about that with you. But just, I don't want to leave listeners on the edge of their seats about what happened to Jackson here, because there's so many compelling paragraphs in your book. But just right here in the beginning, when you mention colistin, the drug that you gave to him, you do write that only colistin had a chance of destroying the infection, but there were no guarantees. The last person I prescribed it to died 12 hours after she received it. The one before that died while receiving it. And Jackson had asked you if he was going to lose his leg, and you said, "I don't think so," as confidently as you could. "We're going to get through this." But you said it wasn't the drug but a surgeon who saved him, meaning what?
That's right. He required a radical surgery to remove what ended up being a very large infection that encompassed both skin and muscle, and then eventually got into the bone. And it was something that had overwhelmed his body's normal immune system, and it required a surgical, what we call an excision, essentially. And eventually he made a full recovery from that. But it did require substantial efforts of what we call a multidisciplinary team of doctors to get him through this. And, you know, that's a phrase that I say a lot to patients. And, you know, when I walk into a room, I try to offer optimism, because people are scared. And it's something that we are working very hard to ensure that we provide the best treatments mm-hmm. to patients. And sometimes those include non-antibiotic options.
Right. Well, I want to play a little bit of tape here because people are scared for a reason. They hear things like this, or maybe they even experience it in their own lives. This is Kimmy Linneman. She's in this tape, you hear her talk about her husband's battle with a MRSA infection. That's multidrug-resistant Staph aureus, right? Ultimately, her husband did survive, but it was only after 6 months and five surgeries that her medical team, her husband's medical team, found an antibiotic that worked.
The doctor basically told me at that point that it had gone to his brain, that there wasn't a lot that they could do because he was on the highest, most potent antibiotic that they know to treat MRSA. And I faced the realization that I might lose him. And at 30 years old, I wasn't ready to be a widow or to be a single mom.
So Matt McCarthy, when we hear stories like that, and yet you say, here you are with your book and your own experience to provide hope, where are those slivers of hope coming from?
Yeah, you know, hearing that tape reminds me of many of the patient encounters I have now, holding somebody's hand at the bedside, looking on at a patient who is spiking fevers and has an infection. And one of the things that I try to offer people is that we have a remarkable array of treatments, and not only these treatments, but also containment strategies, and we have all kinds of people working behind the scenes to ensure that people can make these recoveries. And that has been my experience as an infectious disease doctor, is to make sure that we offer hope and give people the best information available.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk about the cutting edge science here that also, you say, should give us hope in perhaps creating a new generation of antibiotics. I'm talking with Matt McCarthy. He is a staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital and author of the new book, Superbugs: The Race to Stop an Epidemic. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with Dr. Matt McCarthy. He's author of the new book, Superbugs: The Race to Stop an Epidemic. Dr. McCarthy, you know, for half a century at least, if not more, it has been so easy to take for granted the extreme efficacy of antibiotics, right? Like we're living in a world where maybe you don't have to be all that worried, or at least you didn't have to be all that worried to get a cut now. But you're saying, it sounds like you're saying that we are once again perhaps returning to a state that we were in the early, in the late 19th century, early 1900s, that small things like a cut could turn deadly.
You're absolutely right. You know, what I write about in the book is I begin with there's this history of antibiotic discovery that's extraordinary, from Alexander Fleming with penicillin to the 1950s, which became known as this golden era of drug discovery, where we had new antibiotics coming out, it seemed like every few months, and they were dramatically extending the life expectancy of humans. But then something happened, which is that a number of prominent scientists came out in the 60s and said, we got this. We have figured out a way to conquer human infection. And we turned our attention to other issues like heart disease and cancer. And while that happened, the bacteria were evolving and they were developing ways to become resistant to the treatments that we had, the ones that had proved so valuable. And it wasn't until really the 1990s that we got a grasp of just how bad this problem had become. And that happened at a time that Big Pharma had decided mm-hmm. to become much more selective in their investment. And increasingly, they said, why would we invest in an antibiotic? This is a product that doctors try to prescribe as sparingly as possible and that eventually will become unusable because the bacteria will figure out a way to evade it. And that's a stark contrast to, say, a drug like a cholesterol medicine where you know, patients take it every day for the rest of their lives. And they said, we don't want to make drugs that doctors aren't going to enthusiastically prescribe.
Yeah.
And that has led to this breaking point where we need to come up with new methods to spur the investment of new antibiotics.
Well, to underscore that point, you reference a study from the London School of Economics that estimates that the value of a new antibiotic for a pharma company is minus $50 million.
That's exactly right. And I think a great case study in this is an antibiotic called plazomicin. And it was a drug that a company called Achaogen spent years and millions of dollars to develop. And it was finally approved by the FDA last June. And the company filed for bankruptcy last month. And the reason for that is that these drugs are not generating the profits that can justify the profound investment that it takes to go through all of the regulatory hurdles to bring a drug discovered in a laboratory to the patients. And that is a very rigorous process, and it's rigorous by necessity. We can't just start exposing patients to every drug that seems promising. And what I wanted to write about is I wanted to give readers a sense of the next time someone forwards you an article about an exciting new drug for MRSA, for example, I want readers to understand how likely it would be that that drug may actually end up in a hospital near you. It's possible, but there are a number of hurdles that have to be cleared before any new drug gets added. And I'll tell you, but new drugs get added, approved by the FDA all the time, and that does not mean that your hospital chooses to carry them.
Uh-huh.
Many of these are priced extraordinarily expensively, and the pharmacy budgets may not be able to handle them. And so you've got this push and pull between the pharmaceutical companies and the hospitals, and you've got patients caught in between. And that's really what's at the heart of my book.
Wow. Well, let's get a caller in here. Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Holton, Maine. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a couple of questions with respect to the fact that everything's being resistant and doctors are not wanting to prescribe things because they don't work. Is there a more effective way for them to actually be able to prescribe these medications and get one that's actually going to work instead of just giving something for a sinus infection that typically works, and then you take it, seems like it's done a good job, and then a couple months later you get your infection back, and all you've done is given that bacteria an education.
Yeah.
But there's no follow-up with the doctors for them to, say, hey, how's that doing?
Right. Mary, thank you for your call. Go ahead, Dr. McCarthy.
No, Mary, what you've hit on here is one of the things that I write about, is that this issue of multi-drug-resistant bacteria, we talk a lot about the treatments for them, but a crucial aspect of it is the diagnostics, that we need to invest in better diagnostic assays so that we can identify what the organism is that's affecting your sinus, for example, your sinuses, and what are the treatments that are likely to work. Many doctors do not have access to the incredible diagnostic tests that, for example, I have in my hospital, where if I see a patient who's got a runny nose, I can figure out very quickly what's causing it. Is it a bacteria or is it a virus? And would an antibiotic be appropriate? Many doctors in our country do not have access to these. And around the world, it's an even bigger problem. And that leads to the inappropriate prescription of antibiotics, and that promotes the growth of these multi-drug-resistant organisms. And that's just a fraction of the problem. We haven't even gotten to what's going on in agriculture and in farming and what's going on in the tulip gardens in the Netherlands with the antifungal drugs we use there. So this is a global problem, but a crucial aspect of it is better diagnostic tests.
It is true that any conversation about drug-resistant pathogens must mention the use of veterinary antibiotics, but we don't have time for that right now.
Yes.
Dr. McCarthy, though, I want to ask you, one of the main stories in your book is that despite these bureaucratic, institutional, and economic and even evolutionary challenges that you're laying out in terms of the development of new antibiotics, you dive in head first. You help lead a clinical trial involving a brand new antibiotic called Dalba. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So what I wanted to do was I'm interested as a researcher in figuring out when new antibiotics are approved, do they make sense for my patients and how best can we use them? And I was struck by the fact that there was this new drug that had been approved that had an extraordinary property, which is that you give one dose and it can stay in your system for weeks. And our hospital wasn't carrying it. And the reason is that the company was charging thousands of dollars for it, for a single dose. And that is a difficult thing for a pharmacy budget to handle. And so I design these studies where we say, is there a way to use this new drug in a way that benefits patients and benefits the hospital? And so I took on this trial, and I used that as a lens through which to look at this issue of how hard it is to make new antibiotics, and then more importantly, to get them to the patients. Because just because a drug is approved does not mean that the hospital has the capacity to carry it or that you have the infectious disease specialists who know how to use it. And so what I then talk about are these new incentives that are on the being proposed to get the pharmaceutical companies to make more products. They're known as push and pull incentives. A push incentive is one to say to a pharmaceutical company, if you, you're making $3 billion a year making Botox, for example, mm-hmm. we'll cut your corporate tax rate by 2% if you promise to invest some of those excess profits into new antibiotics. And then there's a pull incentive, which is to say, if you are fortunate enough to get a new drug approved by the FDA, we will extend your market exclusivity from, say, 5 or 7 years to 25 years. Now, this to me is one of the most interesting and important political conversations that we're not yet having. And that is, how should the government intervene and how should the government stimulate the investment in further future antibiotics? A lot of people recoil at the idea of giving tax breaks to multi-billion dollar companies. But these are the proposals that we're going to be thinking about. And these are the issues that we actually should be asking our politicians about. We're running out of new antibiotics. What's your proposal to fix this? It's an issue that no one is yet talking about mm-hmm. during the burgeoning 2020 campaign.
Well, so what happened, though, in the case of your hospital and Delba?
Well, we found that we could treat patients successfully, we could reduce the length of stay, we could actually save the hospital money by using these drugs up front. And those are called pharmacoeconomic analyses, and they get very complicated. But the bottom line is that we could improve the way that medical care is delivered with this wonderful new antibiotic, but we have to use it judiciously. And that ends up being a very complicated task of getting a lot of doctors in the room and saying, let's look at the data. How can we use this to benefit everyone involved? And that's going to be the future, really, of antibiotic development. Just because a drug is approved by the FDA does not mean we know how to use it in a way that benefits everyone.
Mm. Go back to the phones here. Let's go to Howard, who's calling from Davie, Florida. Howard, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll make it very brief. I returned from Europe last night after a 10-hour flight. We went on a cruise for my 60th birthday. I contracted something, and first they told me it was norovirus, which is not bacterial. So I said, then why are you giving me two IV bags? This is on the ship. I won't say the name of the cruise line for why you're probably not allowed to broadcast it. But anyway, the ship's doctor gave me two IVs, one in each arm, with an antifungal or seizure medication for my bowels. First they said, oh, it's probably norovirus. So if it's norovirus, why are you giving me Cipro?
Yeah.
He says, well, it might be bacterial. He says, we don't know. We're going to give you Cipro. So they gave me Cipro. They gave me Cipro pills. They gave me another drip antibiotic, another drip of miconazole. They gave me Lomitol, which uh-huh. is an anti-diarrhea medicine that has some atropine in it. They said mm-hmm. my bowels were like red raw, and I couldn't hold anything down. Then my potassium crashed. I'm 60. This cruise was for my 60th birthday.
Yeah. And so, Howard, how are you now?
Well, I just came back from my regular doctor, somebody that went to a U.S. medical school. Not saying that foreign medical schools are bad, but I can hardly understand this guy. He's from the Ukraine, and he works on the ship.
Right.
So, anyway, my doctor gave me different medicine to take. He said they treated you like you have IB and you don't have IB. He said, but your potassium was so low, they probably thought you were circling the drain and they had to bring it back up quickly.
Well, Howard, I'm going to take it back from you there. And thank you so much for that harrowing guide through what happened to you on a cruise ship. Dr. McCarthy, what do you think of that?
You know, the Howard story is one that I hear all too frequently. My morning typically starts in our emergency room hearing from a patient who may or may not have had an infection and is coming in feeling very confused, saying, the doctor didn't even really know what was going on and prescribed me a bunch of stuff. I don't know if it worked. He didn't know if it worked. What's going on? And what I wanted to address in writing this book is all of this confusion. How do we get around some of these complex issues, and how do we address them in a way that people can actually relate to and understand? And what happened on that cruise ship is that you unquestionably had a doctor with limited diagnostic capabilities who was probably nervous and overprescribed and said, let's just cover everything. And that's an issue that got us into trouble in the first place, that we give broad-spectrum antibiotics just in case. And increasingly, you know, we talk about precision medicine. We don't want to give stuff just in case, because every antibiotic has potential side effects. Yeah. And that includes harming our good bacteria. And we want to get better treatments, but also better diagnostics so that we know what we're doing.
Well, Dr. McCarthy, we only have a few minutes left. And there's two other areas that I definitely want to explore with you. One on the hopeful side and one on the challenging side. Okay. On the hopeful side, we have a question here coming in from G. Welch, who wonders, is there a future in using CRISPR or other gene editing tools on viruses to turn them into bacteriophages for a new generation of antibiotics?
Yes. So the short answer is absolutely. Yeah. It's an extraordinary time of development in the CRISPR area where, for the people who aren't familiar with it, it's essentially a molecular scalpel where you can cut pieces of DNA out and insert new pieces. And there are these cocktails that they're making of three different bacteriophages, which have been genetically engineered, which can target a specific pathogen. After you read my book, you'll understand why that there is hope, but also why that we need to be cautiously optimistic, because it's going to cost at least $1 billion to bring that cocktail to patients. And we have to figure out who is going to invest in that. Should this be the federal government that's strictly promoting this? Should we be partners with Big Pharma? Should we accept the fact that the pharmaceutical industry is not going to support us and we do it on our own? And I quote one pharmaceutical CEO who says he has an ethical mandate to raise the price of every antibiotic as high as he can because he's accountable to shareholders and not to patients.
That's not an ethical mandate, then. That's a financial mandate. I agree. So that's on the side of the possibilities of new science, right, with gene editing tools. But, you know, this is one of those stories and issues where it's the gap between science and the practice of medicine, really, that's part of the problem. Because on the practice of medicine side, you've also written that medical residencies, for example, can't find enough med students who want to – they can't fill their infectious disease residencies with med students who are graduating, because people in your specialty sometimes get paid, what, 10, 20, 30% less than even primary care physicians.
Yeah, that's right. I had an op-ed in the New York Times last month talking about how we've got addressing multi-drug resistant bacteria in so many different ways, and we're talking about the new treatments and diagnostics. But the thing nobody recognizes is that very few doctors want to actually become an expert in infectious diseases, and that we're not training as many people as we could. And the reason for that is largely financial, that you have to often take a pay cut to be an infectious disease specialist. And that has to do with a complicated calculation about how physicians are reimbursed. And so I think that this is going to be a multi-pronged attack to address this problem. And one of those issues that we must address is incentivizing physicians to become these types of specialists.
Right. I mean, they're not reimbursed at the same rates because they're not performing the procedures that get reimbursement, right?
That's
You talk about how it's a kind of an intellectual pursuit.
It's infectious diseases like nephrology is a cognitive specialty, or there are many of them where instead of performing a procedure, you're doing giving expert consultation, and that doesn't generate the same revenue. And that's an issue that we need to address to ensure that we've got the right treatments and the people who know how to use them.
So all of this is happening while at the same time, we just have 30 seconds now, but you say the FDA has approved some new antibiotics, but to get back to the point you were just making, maybe a lot of doctors don't know that they exist, these new antibiotics, or they couldn't even pronounce them or how to use them.
That's what I said in my op-ed, is that we've got to get people familiar with these new drugs. And the only way we can do that is by training experts to show others how to use them. And that's going to be one of the at the forefront of the next generation here. And I think that it's ultimately a story of hope, but also tremendous challenges. But we're meeting that challenge head on right now.
Well, Dr. Matt McCarthy is a staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital and author of the new book, Superbugs: The Race to Stop an Epidemic. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Dr. McCarthy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take a look at the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The second largest outbreak of Ebola has killed more than 1,000 people already in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And over the past month, new cases have increased at the fastest rate yet. However, some residents are suspicious of doctors and vaccines, and fighting between rebels and government forces is making containing the outbreak significantly harder. Last month, gunmen killed one World Health Organization doctor. And community leader Jamali Musa from Beni worries about the effects of the violence.
Insecurity will scare away the doctors helping to fight against Ebola. If they leave, then the virus will spread and it will kill even more people. It's a real danger.
You can join the conversation. What lessons do you think we learned from the last Ebola outbreak, and how can we help best contain this one? And joining us now from Butembo in the Democratic Republic of Congo is Tariq Rebel. He is Emergency Response Director for the International Rescue Committee and has been there coordinating efforts on the ground for the Ebola outbreak. Tariq, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us today is Joya Mukherjee. She's joining us from Boston. She's Chief Medical Officer for Partners in Health and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. During the 2014-2016 West Africa Ebola outbreak, she was in Liberia and Sierra Leone working with aid groups on the ground there. Joya Mukherjee, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna.
So, Tariq, first of all, let me turn to you there in Butembo. Give us a sense as to how what you're seeing with the Ebola outbreak right now.
We've unfortunately seen a steady deterioration of the epidemic in the past 3 or so months, with the number of cases steadily increasing. And that increase is directly correlated with the increased acts of violence in those months. Toward the end of February, we had several incidents where the Ebola treatment centers in Butembo were attacked and set on fire, which led to Doctors Without Borders leaving Butembo at the time. And since then, we had the killing of Dr. Ishav, the World Health Organization, which you mentioned, in April, and we had another very serious incident a couple of weeks ago. These have led to constant disruptions to the work and also to an overall tension in the community that is really palpable, making it very difficult to work and causing the cases to increase.
Tariq, why are these attacks happening?
I think we need to, when we look at the security situation, we need to differentiate two things. One, there's been a general sense of tension in the community, which we can link to sort of possibly things that, we see in many epidemics, which is that unless we're able to link with communities with a good engagement strategy, there can be a lot of misunderstandings, there can be a lot of confusion about the epidemic, about the way that the epidemic response works. And I think we unfortunately had that. I think a lot was invested on medical treatment and on vaccination, but community engagement possibly didn't receive the attention it deserved from the outset. And this has led to tensions around burials, around the vaccination, around Ebola treatment centers that we've seen. But most of the incidents that have come out of that have been more minor. They've been sort of eruptions of emotions by people dealing with those teams. The much more serious incidents fall into a second category, where there seem to be that are operating and causing things to happen against the response that are very serious. They're not directly related to these community tensions, but obviously, these crimes need to be prosecuted, and the people brought to account.
Well, Joya Mukherjee, let me turn to you here, because the last major outbreak, which began in West Africa in 2013, killed more than 11,000 people, ultimately. Yeah. So why do you it was terrible. So why do you think, what is driving the level of distrust that I hear Tariq is talking about in the community now? I mean, isn't there an even greater concern that we could have a repetition of the terrible 2013-2016 outbreak?
Yeah. Well, I mean, thank you, Meghna, and thank you, Tariq, and the IRC for all this great work. Partners in Health is not directly engaged in Congo, but our chief medical officer from Sierra Leone is supporting the effort there with several groups on the ground. And I think your question is a really good one, Meghna. And, you know, what drives that fear? What drives that mistrust? Is any number of things. And if we think of the death toll in the Congo in the last 20 years that has been largely neglected by the West.
Millions and millions of people.
Millions of people. There have been efforts, very misplaced efforts that have harmed people from, you know, who was sheltered in refugee camps to, you know, what was the role of different armies and peacekeepers. So we've sort of looked aside at this, and, you know, Congo has been a neglected area. What we saw within Liberia and Sierra Leone is the health systems in these conflict countries, and remember that Sierra Leone and Liberia were not in active conflict, but 10 years or so post-conflict, is that the systems haven't worked for the people. The health systems haven't worked for the people for a very long time. They're underfunded, they've been destroyed, and so then you come to this very terrifying epidemic, and why would people anticipate that that the system would support them? Why would they? They have no really logical reason. Now, as Tariq is saying, you know, community engagement is key, but it has to be community engagement with treatment, because one of the things that really we feel, all of us, got the Ebola outbreak so out of hand in West Africa was, you know, there was not enough effective treatment. So it was hard to, you know, find cases and get people to go to these holding centers where they would definitely die. Now, what we hear, and I was just in discussion with our Dr. Lotto, who's there on behalf of PIH, is there is very good treatment. There's, you know, very high standards, the kind of standards we've been fighting for more than 5 years, IV fluids, medicines, checking of laboratories, and then the use of new medicines, which are critical, vaccination of contacts. So we're doing better on the treatment side, but not as well on the community engagement side. And I think this mistrust only can be mitigated through this combination, this important combination of community engagement and adequate treatment, and then understanding we've neglected this area for so long.
Yeah, so just to underscore that point, I mean, the millions of people who have died in the wars in the Democratic Republic of Congo, that you're right. I mean, the rest of the world has turned has ignored for quite some time. And perhaps because of that, I'm seeing here the reporting that, for example, in a particular region of the DRC, only 2% of those recently surveyed said they even trusted the national government. And so that's one of the reasons why perhaps conspiracy theories around the spread of Ebola have been able to take root. But Tariq, you're there in Butembo. Let me just ask you, on a day-to-day basis right now, I mean, have you been in situations where there's been tensions or fear for you and your staff members?
Absolutely. Actually, on during the killing of Dr. Shah on April 19th, actually in a hospital that we support for IPC work, infection prevention and control. And so we had six staff present and the driver while all that was happening. Then we had two triages that were burnt down, separate incidents in the Butembo area. Happily, no staff were present when the arsons happened, but it was very serious. So staff are dealing with those sorts of incidents, but then it gets even to the day-to-day sort of interactions they've had. Some of them have had to lie about being a nurse or a doctor in order to be able to rent a house because real estate agents are worried about having even being a potential client. So it's even at that level where you really feel it, and people are, you know, being careful. Our staff have to be careful sort of in day-to-day interactions. So there's been a lot of it's been a very tense situation to work in, and very difficult for everyone, I think.
Wow. Joya Mukherjee, is there a concern now, or perhaps has there been for several weeks, that even as the outbreak perhaps is more or less in one particular region, that it could spill over?
Yes. I mean, of course, and we do a lot of work. Partners in Health is very engaged in Rwanda, and I know all the countries neighboring Congo, you know, this is on the doorstep of several countries, and Rwanda is working actively in preparedness to try to make sure that we can find things quickly. And, you know, as there is more development, deforestation, et cetera, it's very complicated to control the epidemic. And that's what happened in West Africa. Many people have even linked the level of deforestation and increased movement of populations to the wide, you know, spread of the epidemic. So, of course, that is very important to think about. So, yeah, we're preparing for that in Rwanda. We're on high alert. Mm. I know other countries in the region as well, but this is a mobile population. There are many, you know, many people who go across the border for commerce, for other things. So, yes.
Wow. Well, we actually have some callers here, so let's go to them. Gideon is calling from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Gideon, you're on the air.
Yes, Megan, I'm a big fan of yours anyways. Yes. My comment is, we once had this Ebola in Liberia and Sierra Leone. And we had the vaccinations and the medication that were able to curtail it. So why don't the leaders, the former leader of Liberia, Shirley Johnson, Her Excellency, and her counterpart from Sierra Leone, fly over to the Congo and addressing the people that look it? We have this epidemic in our country, mm-hmm. and these medications that you are rejecting, they work for us. So what is the big deal?
Yeah.
At least we have feminine voice. I believe it will echo to the ears of the people, and then they can take it from there.
Yeah. Gideon, thank you so much for your call. So Joya Mukherjee, you heard Gideon there saying, mm-hmm. is there an opportunity for, you know, major African leaders like Ellen Sirleaf Johnson to lend their voice to build trust in the communities where the outbreak is currently going on?
Well, I would leave that question to Tariq, but I would say that I think Dr. Tedros of the WHO, who is a very well-known African leader, has made several trips to the region, has met with community leaders and others. I think Those things can help, and I know that Dr. Tedros has just asked Ma Ellen, as she's called, to be involved in some of the universal health coverage work as well. But I think at the end of the day, it's really the long-term getting deep in the community. It's not as much about rallying people, but about really a long-term presence. But I would love to hear Tariq's opinion as well.
Well, Tariq, go ahead.
Yeah, I think we're actually at a very interesting point here, because one of the key issues we've had to deal with is the politicization of the response. You touched on the fact that only 2% of people trust the national government. And one of the key points of contention has been that led by a federal agency, by the Ministry of Health, in an opposition area. And even though the Ministry of Health itself has remained, has done its best to try to remain apolitical, the national election in December was canceled in the end due to the Ebola epidemic. And a lot of this has led to a lot of a lot of people that lost their votes blaming the Ebola response and blaming this for being for us having a political agenda. We've also seen several different leaders locally. And we've seen, and that's why, like the caller said, is interesting in a different way. We are seeing that change right now, and we're seeing important leaders that are very respected here starting to speak out openly and saying, you know, this disease could kill us. One even made a reference to the plague in Europe and said, you know, it's only when people get together and start realizing how to stop infection that this can stop. Otherwise, you know, we're losing our people. And we really welcome that and really hope that the politicization of the disease will stop in all forms, because it definitely has had an impact in the past months.
Well, Tariq, your line is starting to degrade here. I hope it holds on for at least another 90 seconds. But Joya, I do have to ask you one more question, because this time around we have a vaccine that has been, an Ebola vaccine that's been given to, more than 100,000 people. Yeah. Certainly that's made a difference in trying to fight the current outbreak.
Yeah, I think there are multiple things that have made a difference. Vaccinating the contacts of everyone who's identified is a key infection control strategy. And as I said before, providing excellent care is also a key way to control the epidemic, because people come earlier and they're more likely to speak positively about their experience, obviously. But again, with all of this works when you have good systems. And, you know, we're working in a place that really doesn't have systems. And even the vaccination, of course, that can, you know, bring all kinds of concerns from people who are already having a lot of mistrust. So this work at the community level is critical.
Right. And at the same time, right now, we have frontline responders, those burial teams and volunteers and physicians, as we've been talking about, who are under such danger that they're trying to keep their work, in many cases, secret from even their own neighbors. So Joya Mukherjee, Chief Medical Officer for Partners in Health, and teaches infectious diseases at Harvard University, and during the 2014-2016 Ebola outbreak in West Africa, worked in close partnership with groups in Liberia and Sierra Leone. Joya Mukherjee, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Magda.
And Tariq Rebel joining us today from Butembo in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's the Emergency Response Director for the International Rescue Group. Tariq Rebel, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.